Hi, I'm Tyler.
I'm Justin.
And I'm Pamela.
We are three undergraduate students at the University of Victoria. We are working with the Landscapes of Injustice Project, and we created this podcast to talk to you about the dispossession of Japanese Canadians during World War II. More specifically, about the role of the Soldier Settlement Board during this process. But before that, maybe I should rewind and make sure we are all on the same page here. Why were they being dispossessed, and what do I even mean by that? Well, shortly after the nation of Japan bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, Japan was considered an enemy of Canada, and this facilitated the labeling of all Japanese Canadians as, quote, enemy aliens, whose property could, apparently, be taken over by the Canadian state and sold without consent or compensation.
And, of course, you should know what the Soldier Settlement Board was in the first place. They were a government agency established after World War I, meant to assist returning servicemen with setting up farms. In British Columbia, the board acted to appraise and purchase farms belonging to Japanese Canadians, supposedly for this purpose. Now that that's been explained, Pamela can get us started.
So what kind of justifications or rationales did administrators on the Soldier Settlement Board provide for the dispossession of Japanese Canadians? Well, in several of these letters, the dispossession is framed from an economic perspective, with several different justifications within this category being given. Before their forced uprooting from the coast, Japanese Canadians had played a vital role in the farming of small fruit in British Columbia, especially in strawberries and raspberries. As a result of them being forced off their lands, these farms were now sitting vacant, not producing any fruit. So in the eyes of administrators on the Soldier Settlement Board, this was creating a huge hole in BC's economy, and something had to be done quickly to get laborers onto these farms. So on September 2nd, 1942, District Superintendent Barnett wrote a letter to Gordon Murchison, the director of the Soldier Settlement Board. As the director, Murchison was the only one who could approve the lease or sale of the Japanese Canadian properties, who were being held by the custodian of alien property. In the letter, Barnett outlined the situation of farming in British Columbia before the dispossession of Japanese Canadians. So he starts out by talking about crops and the price of fruits in BC at this time. And then he presents a table that divides farm acreage in the Fraser Valley in 1940 between, quote, whites and, quote, orientals. And in describing these categories, he notes that there will be a small number of Chinamen under the heading of orientals. The Chinaman, however, has not been engaged to any extent in the past in the growing of small fruits. Therefore, so far as small fruits are concerned, the Orientals were almost exclusively of the Japanese race, end quote. So this category refers almost entirely to farm acreage that is owned by Japanese Canadians. Barnett then gives the figures, stating that, quote, roughly two-thirds of the acreage in strawberries was in the hands of Orientals, end quote. So this is the category that he's just told us is made up almost entirely of Japanese Canadians. And here Barnett is describing what he sees as an economic problem. He's letting us know just what a big part of BC's small fruit farming industry Japanese Canadians were responsible for. And so the implication here is that with these farms now vacant, with the Japanese being forced into internment camps further east, BC's economy is going to take a serious hit in the years to come. So at one point in the letter, Barnett states that, quote, this whole table is very interesting and informative to us in handling the Japanese situation, end quote. He seems pretty removed from any concern over mistreatment or discrimination towards the Japanese Canadians. Instead, the, quote, Japanese problem, as he describes it, is a hindrance to the BC economy. In a letter from Gordon Murchison to Crerar, he stresses an urgency to get tenants onto these properties very quickly. So he says, quote, we are now at the end of November, and anyone who understands agriculture in the Fraser Valley knows that leases for 1943 should be generally arranged and in the hands of tenants before the end of February. Otherwise, with the present labor market, people are going to do something else, end quote. We can see from this comment that for Crerar, it's important to get the ball rolling, as it were. Economically, it's necessary to get tenants on these properties quickly to be able to farm. The Soldier Settlement Board is concerned about this because they want to ensure that the farms continue to be profitable and beneficial to the BC economy. So the Soldier Settlement Board went on to lease the agricultural properties of Japanese Canadians. In another letter from Barnett to Mertensen, Barnett talks about the interest people had in leasing these properties. His letter states, quote, "We are continuing to have a steady stream of people inquiring about Japanese properties in regard to leasing, etc. Some of them are even getting to the point of calling me on my house phone on Sundays," end quote. So this is a kind of economic opportunism. This agency is moving in and profiting off the dispossession of Japanese Canadians. And Barnett actually continues by saying, quote, "We have submitted to the custodian a total of 45 applications to lease to have the agreements drawn, and a further 18 have been sent out to tenants for their signature. Negotiations of one kind or another are also being conducted on a large number of other properties," end quote. These actions all concerned the lease of Japanese-Canadian properties. The final outcome was that on January 23, 1943, an order in council was passed that permitted the custodian of enemy alien property to sell Japanese-Canadian properties without their consent. And so the question, therefore, that we can ask ourselves is, was the problem really solely an economic one in the eyes of these administrators? Or was this instead a pretext to prevent Japanese Canadians from returning to their properties, therefore permanently removing them from British Columbia?
Thanks, Pamela. That's very interesting. It sounds like Barnett had a very influential voice, and that leads nicely into what I would like to talk about. I think it's very important that we discuss the obvious conflict of interest that was being perpetrated during the liquidation of Japanese Canadian farms in British Columbia during 1942 and 1943. We can see through archived correspondences between politicians and civil servants, such as those presented to us by Pamela, that many were unperturbed by this. Let's take, for example, a letter dated April 27, 1942, from New Westminster Member of Parliament Thomas Reid, addressed to Ian MacKenzie, Minister of Pensions and National Health. MacKenzie was a British Columbia career politician of over two decades, a known racist, and one of the main proponents behind Japanese-Canadian dispossession. In the letter, Reid writes, quote, "All the Japanese lands and property should, I believe, be placed under the control of the director of the Soldier Settlement Board, who should be made custodian of the same. Following this, a survey should be made by his officials with the view of their choosing and selecting suitable holdings on which could be placed ex-servicemen under the new land settlement scheme," end quote. Now, let's break down what this means. Reid is basically suggesting that the director of the Soldier Settlement Board should be given complete authority to survey, assess, and select land and property confiscated from interned Japanese Canadians. How could Director Gordon Murchison have been expected to look out for the interests of interned Japanese Canadians when his primary interest was to acquire their property as quickly and cheaply as possible? This shines light on the paternalistic views of government organ officials and politicians of the time. They thought that they knew what was best for ethnic minority groups that they saw to be, quote, inferior to themselves. To show that Reid wasn't an anomaly, here is another letter, also dated April 27, 1942, from the Minister of Mines and Resources, Thomas A. Creer. Creer addresses MacKenzie, telling him, quote, "It is my view that action might be taken by order in council under the War Measures Act to forbid the purchase or lease of any of these properties by any person, firm, or corporation unless such transactions are first approved by a referee appointed by the Dominion government," end quote. Later in the letter, he says, quote, "Since the Director of Soldier Settlement has been authorized to proceed with examination and appraisal of these properties, it would seem logical that the director might be appointed for the purpose I have suggested," end quote. He says this in the past tense, implying that the suggestion being made by Thomas Reid in the previous letter had already been implemented, in addition to appraising property values. Clearly, Career did not take this conflict of interest seriously. At an earlier point in this letter, Career uses the word protect, suggesting that by monopolizing the purchase of these farms at prices set by appraisers of the board, Japanese-Canadian interests would be defended. This is absurd, of course, because the plans described in these letters did come true, and Murchison's men spent the summer of 1942 appraising Japanese-Canadian farms. Ann Gomer Sunahara tells us that these men, quote, trained to assess the drought-ravaged farms of southern Saskatchewan in the 1930s. The appraisers applied the same conservative, depression-based criteria employed in Saskatchewan to the fertile and productive Japanese farms in British Columbia, end quote. As a result, the board acquired these farms for less than 70% of their actual value. From what Sunahara and these primary sources tells us, I would wager that this was not an accident. I think this conflict of interest and poor training was deliberately overlooked as part of a calculated plan to acquire Japanese-Canadian farms as affordably and expediently as possible. The language of, quote, protecting Japanese-Canadian interests was used to mask racial prejudice and the prioritization of veteran interests.
Thanks for explaining all that, Tyler. Now, I'd like to address the final questions to be considered, which are, how much did the Soldier Settlement Board pay for the Japanese-Canadian farms? How was this purchase even secured? And was this land actually allocated to returning Japanese-Canadian veterans, as was proposed? Well, to answer the first question, Tyler previously mentioned that the board bought these farms for less than 70% of their actual value. Ann Sunahara explains that this equated to about $850,000 out of an assessed total of more than $1,200,000. Sunahara then goes on to discuss the actions of Ian MacKenzie, who, once again, was the Minister of Pensions and National Health. MacKenzie recognized that the sales of these farms could potentially discourage many uprooted Japanese Canadians from returning to the Pacific Coast, and he sought to make this a reality. I agree with Sunahara's findings and analysis for MacKenzie. While the board's apparent purpose was to assist returning servicemen with setting up farms, MacKenzie's attitude and actions didn't reflect this at all. On April 4th, 1942, he declared, quote, "It is my intention, as long as I remain in public life, to see they never come back here," end quote. MacKenzie's plan began with the Veterans Land Act, as evidenced by a letter that he addresses to Thomas A. Crevier, where he states, quote, "This act will confer upon the director, when he is appointed, the right to buy farms and hold them for prospective settlers," end quote. Here, we can see that the act would allow these lands to be purchased for veteran settlement, while supposedly protecting them from buyers who weren't Japanese-Canadian. Sunahara concludes that the Veterans Land Act by itself wasn't the real key to the success of his plan. Rather, it was the War Measures Act, and the first proposed order in council that followed. Again, I have to agree with these findings, because if we take another look at MacKenzie's letter, he continues to say, quote, "Unfortunately, there is no prospect of the Veterans Land Act becoming law in time for the director appointed thereunder to deal with these properties," end quote. He then makes an immediate request for an order on council under the War Measures Act. This would grant the director of the board legal authority to buy any Japanese farms deemed suitable. The letter proves Sunahara's conclusion, since without the War Measures Act, the board couldn't have legally secured these lands in the first place. In the end, a total of 769 land parcels were purchased by the board, and the purchase did have the effect that MacKenzie desired, and this persisted until April 1st, 1949, when Japanese Canadians were finally allowed to return to the West Coast. MacKenzie's letter by itself is rather vague and doesn't give an accurate representation of his real intention. As we know, the Soldier Settlement Board was supposed to provide assistance to returning veterans, including those who were Japanese-Canadian, but MacKenzie's personal agenda obviously didn't allow for this. His letter doesn't show his bias towards Japanese-Canadians, nor his eagerness to expel them from Canada. But this omission is not surprising. After all, why would MacKenzie spell out his true intentions on paper, risking the chance someone would disagree with him and causing his plan to fail? And he wasn't the only higher-up with these beliefs either. Tyler and Pamela both previously mentioned Gordon Murchison, who was, again, the director of the Soldier Settlement Board. he would eventually admit that his only interests in the farms were making a profit and protecting British Columbia's economy. Based off of this and everything else that we've examined, I believe that this desire to drive the Japanese Canadians off of Canadian soil was shared amongst many other higher-ups in Canada at this time. And for this reason, I'd assume that the placement of the Soldier Settlement Board in this conflict was always meant to secure a profit and get rid of the Japanese Canadians. Nothing more. No matter what was proposed on paper, it's difficult to believe that the board was actually planning to assist them at any point.
Thanks for that, Justin. So just to repeat for effect what's already been said, that 769 Japanese Canadian farms being sold to the Soldier Settlement Board for much less than their actual value. This was an act of pure economic opportunism on behalf of a Canadian governmental agency, exploiting an ethnic minority whose civil liberties had been revoked in a time of heightened racialized anxiety. It constituted an enormous conflict of interest, as the Soldier Settlement Board was responsible for the appraisal, purchase, and the sale of these properties. And as we have shown from primary sources and correspondence between key architects of this agency, its goals were calculated and premeditated. The dispossession of Japanese Canadians was justified using language of paternalism and economics. But let's not forget that underneath lurked taken-for-granted ideas of racial superiority, which provided the very precondition for this scheme. Without this precondition, men such as Barnett, Reed, Creerar, and Mackenzie would never have felt so comfortable hatching and implementing the plans we have been discussing today.